You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm Art Ray. Today, we'll be going to the archives to hear Edgar Evans Cayce talk about Atlantis. Edgar Evans Cayce is the youngest son of Edgar and Gertrude Cayce. Now in his 90s, he was an electrical engineer for 43 years before his retirement. Married for 60 years, he is presently a trustee emeritus of the ARE, the Association for Research and Enlightenment, as well as a devoted grandfather and golfer. One of ARE's authorities on Atlantis, he is one author of the book Mysteries of Atlantis, which explores the latest discoveries in the search for Atlantis, along with evidence of its destruction. He co-authored the book, The Outer Limits of Edgar Cayce's Power, which explores the relatively small number, 200, of readings that appeared to be inaccurate. From the archives, this presentation outlines the readings on Atlantis and ARE's ongoing search for evidence of its existence.
Well, you know, the story of Atlantis originated with Plato a few hundred years ago, a few hundred years B.C., excuse me. He heard it from Solon, who heard it from an Egyptian priest at Sais, and according to them, it was a continent-sized island in the Atlantic Ocean with a high civilization that was destroyed by volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, and floods about 9,000 years previously. Well, that 9,000 years previously has worried people ever since. A lot of authors have written about it. Some of them, they amass evidence to try to prove Plato was right. Some of them try to discredit it by saying it's, you know, it couldn't have been a civilization in Atlantic. It couldn't have been in a high civilization that long ago. And some of them just try to rationalize it by changing the date and the place and say, well, maybe there was something there, but it couldn't have been in Atlantic. It must have been in the Mediterranean or somewhere else. Probably one of the best known authors is Ignatius Donnelly, who wrote Atlantis, the Antediluvian World. He wrote it in 1882, and it was revised by Edgerton Sykes in 1949. Donnelly discusses the legends that are the same on both sides of the Atlantic, customs that are the same, and says that many plants and animals are the same on both sides of the ocean. Those that try to discredit him, or discredit Plato, say there are no other early writings of Atlantis. Plato is only one. They admit that some records of such might have been destroyed when the library at Alexander was burned. And they just say that it wasn't creditable that a highly advanced civilization could have existed that long ago. Now, those who try to rationalize the story and change the location, they say there's no evidence of such a land in the Atlantic, and that just the date is too long ago to be believed. It couldn't have been that long ago. Well, what did Edgar Cayce say about Atlantis? You know, I asked myself the same question back in 1968, before writing my first book on Atlantis. I knew Edgar Cayce had given readings mentioning Atlantis, but neither I nor anyone else at that time knew how many, or when they were given, or what they said, or what information they contained about that legendary land. At that time, the readings had been indexed, and copies of them in the index cards were in the library. There was even a microfilm copy of the readings. But there was no CD-ROM with a search engine. In fact, computers weren't even around then. The 14,000-plus readings had been generally classified. There were about 60% of them were physical readings, a diagnosis of an individual's physical condition. The 20% of them were life readings. The other 20% or just everything under the sun. You could probably break it down into 5% business readings, 4% dream interpretation, and dozens of other titles, 1% or less, such as the work of Edgar Cayce, the ARE, or the study group readings, or mental and spiritual subjects, or oil wells and buried treasure, and so forth. The main source of information I knew would be about Atlantis would be in the life readings. The first life reading was given in 1923. There were two readings that mentioned Atlantis in 23. In the 20s and 30s, that's about 10 per year, life readings. In the 30s and 40s, there were about 20 or 30 per year. From 39 to 44, there were about 40 to 66 readings each year, each of those 10 years, on on life readings. Now, that more readings in the later years is just because he was giving more readings, both kinds, physical and life readings, because after the book came out, There's a River, he started giving more. I was overseas. He lived overseas. There wasn't anybody there but Mother to hold him down, and he started giving 4, 5, 6, 7 readings a day. He was backed up for a month or so at a time, and he had a breakdown, and he had a reading on himself, and it just said he was trying to do too much, and if he didn't stop, it would kill him, and he didn't stop, and it killed him. So he died in 1945. Well, we did have that microfilm, and that was easy to use in index cards, and I sat in the basement up there, the old hospital building, cranking that microfilm around and looking at all the life readings. They were classified into physical readings and life readings, so it was a matter of looking at those 2,500 readings and trying to pick out the life readings and say, look at the incarnations and see which one mentioned Atlantis and what did he say. Well, you know, I thought I could take 2 or 3 days a week, 2 or 3 hours a day, and maybe in a month or two get through it. That was a kind of naive idea. It took me a year to go through those 2,500 readings and make a note of what it said about Atlantis. Now, instead of a land existing 10,000 years ago, it was a different story than Plato had. It was a land that had existed over 200,000 years ago, and it was racked with 3 instead of 1 major disasters. One was about 50,000 B.C. when part of the continent sank. One about 28,000 B.C. when the remaining land was split into islands. And one was about 9 to 10,000 B.C. when the last islands went down. This was probably the destruction that Plato alluded to. Now, the problem was that not many dates were given in those individual readings. But those that were allowed me to group the readings around those 3 periods and see what was happening at the time of each destruction and in between. Now, of the 700 readings on Atlantis, about 3% of 21 readings were associated with that 50,000 B.C. period or earlier. About 52 of the readings, or 7%, are associated with the second destruction. About 352 readings, or almost half, or half, 50% of them, were associated with the final destruction. Now, that leaves 275 readings, or 40%, that you couldn't determine the date. He didn't mention any date, or there was not enough information about that particular incarnation to associate it with any particular period. So sometimes he would say something about Atlantis, but you still couldn't tell what time he was talking about. But the information emerging from the readings was some of the most fantastic and unbelievable that you can imagine. It would have been a lot easier if he'd never mentioned the word. The civilization reached by the Atlanteans, according to Casey, 30 to 50,000 years ago, sounded as high or higher than that of today, with some things spoken of that had not even been discovered yet. For example, in a reading, 26239, given in February the 21st, 1933, he's speaking of an Atlantean power source that sounded like some kind of ray. And he said this would be discovered in the next 25 years. Well, 25 years from 1933 to 1958. Now, from between 55 and 58, there was discovery of the anti-electron, antiproton, in other words, antimatter. And the combination of antimatter with ordinary matter would give you an explosion or power source much greater than that of a hydrogen or atomic bomb. Now, another thing that happened in 1958 exactly, let me read to you from page 41 of this book. In the interesting to ponder Casey's reference to the death ray and the statement would be discovered in the next 25 years, that is, by 1958. In 1958, 3 engineers at Bell Telephone Labs succeeded in constructing and operating a maser, or the forerunner of the laser. Of course, since then, the uses of masers and lasers have become widespread in communications, medicine, and many other fields. The use of a laser, the death ray, is classified, although it's an open secret the military is working on. So, there is probably what he was talking about. It's just interesting that those discoveries keep coming up. Casey spoke of two main divisions of the Atlanteans. One's called the Sons of the Law of One, who believed man was created in the image of God with an immortal soul, and another called the Sons of Belial, who believed the physical was all there was and should be enjoyed selfishly to the fullest. And warring between these two factions had been the cause of one of the first destructions by setting off volcanic eruptions. A point that came out of these readings was that many souls that lived in Atlantis were reincarnating in the present and faced the same problems similar to those of the Atlanteans, and could face similar destructions or could make decisions that could avoid such problems.
We'll be right back with more with Edgar Evans Casey on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. We're back with Edgar Evans Casey.
As time went on, the readings began to make sense, for the development of nuclear energy and atomic weapons provided a means for blasting man back to the Stone Age, particularly if accompanied by earth changes as a result of a nuclear war. Now, in spite of this being the first book I ever wrote, it did real well. It's been in print ever since 1968, every year since 68, sold about 1 million copies and been translated into 6 languages, including Hebrew. Let's jump over to 1988, 20 years later. Discoveries continued to be made, substantiating what Casey said about the past. When many readings were given in the 20s and 30s, the ideas of geology and archaeology were quite different from now. Man's age in the earth was thought to be in the hundreds of thousands of years, not in the millions. No one thought the poles had ever shifted. Everybody knew the Indians hadn't been in North America over 2,000 or 3,000 years, and they knew the poles hadn't shifted, hadn't been any climatic changes, and to talk about stuff like that sounded ridiculous. Well, now radiocarbon dating has pushed man's time in the Americas to 17,500 in Pennsylvania, 20,000 in California, 35,000 BC in South America. Discoveries in Africa has extended man's time in the earth to millions of years instead of hundreds of thousands. Maybe it was time to update the book. All these things were happening. Knowing what a job it was to write the first one and being 20 years older, I enlisted the help of my daughter Gail and Dr. Douglas Richards as co-authors. Gail got a BS degree from Ohio State and worked 15 to 20 years here at the ARE. She was here when the readings were first indexed. Doug got his PhD at University of North Carolina and served as director of research at the ARE. The three of us together wrote Mysteries of Atlantis Revisited. Here's a specific example of one of the things Edgar Casey mentioned in the reading that at the time was unable to be checked, but has since proven to be accurate. About the Nile River. Let me see, it's on page 67. Was Casey's ancient geography correct? What have we learned since Casey's time that could prove him right or wrong? Although the existence of Atlantis as a continent is still a matter of some controversy, the views of the readings on geology and geological processes are receiving more and more support. On the surface, Casey's statement describes a world different from that today. So the Sahara as a fertile land, the Nile running into the Atlantic Ocean. Yet skeptical opinions have frequently been formed more from lack of evidence than from any strong evidence against Casey's concepts. The existence of Atlantis is still controversial, yet one of Casey's most unlikely statements, that the Nile once flowed into the Atlantic Ocean, has recently been confirmed using satellite radar and photography. The Nile is an outstanding example of how rapidly scientific opinion can change when new evidence appears. The reading stated, this was from a reading in 1925, then man's indwelling was in the Sahara and the upper Nile regions, and the waters then entering the now Atlantic from the Nile rather than flowing northward. This was May 28, 1925. Here's another reading. The Nile, or N-O-L-E, Nole, then emptied into what is now the Atlantic Ocean on the Congo end of the country. This was in July 13th of 25. Now another one, this same land now called Egypt, this was before the mountains rose in the south, when the waters called the Nile then emptied into what is now the Atlantic Ocean. This February 20th, 1931. Now, the Casey descriptions of the ancient Nile, including the dates of 10 million years ago, are now very close to the opinion of the scientific mainstream. In an article published in Science in August 1968, Robert R. Kerr discussed how using the shuttle imaging radar in the space shuttle, scientists discovered a previously unseen network of river valleys beneath the driest part of the Sahara, where Libya, Egypt, and the Sudan meet. When sites along the rivers were excavated, the scientists found 250,000-year-old riverside campsites. The source of the river was the Red Sea hills between the Red Sea and the present-day Nile, and the river flowed across the Sahara into the Atlantic at the bottom of the bulge of West Africa, exactly where Casey said. Casey pinpointed the location of human habitation in the upper Nile regions. Upper referring to the headwaters area, an area now confirmed as fertile. The data determined by the new findings was also consistent with the Casey dates. Casey spoke of the Nile flowing into the Atlantic 10 million years ago and of later settlements in the area. The new discoveries have established that this ancient Nile probably existed up until almost 6 million years ago when the rise of mountains changed its course and it cut its present valley toward the Mediterranean. So there's three or four statements that were ridiculous when he talked about them, but have since been proven accurate. So certainly, whether he was right on Atlantis, he was right on his geology and archaeology up so far. Well, the statements in the readings that about geology have since been proven to be accurate. Maybe his statements about Atlantis will prove as accurate as well. In the book of this Mysteries of Atlantis Revisited, that was the one we updated, I wrote a forward about my father. There's an example of a physical reading and a life reading so people could get a feel for the information given, the way it was given. Part one covers various accounts of the Atlantis legend featuring writers both pro and con, plus a summary of Edgar Casey's story. Part two discusses the recent discoveries in geology and archaeology that have continued to substantiate what Casey said in his readings. Part three details a quest for evidence in both Egypt and Bimini. The paperback edition, reprinted in 1997, contains a chapter containing the most recent discoveries between 1988 and 1997. You know, some of you may not know, the ARE sponsored an effort to carbon date the Great Pyramid. Now, of course, you can't carbon date stone, but you can carbon date any kind of organic matter that's in the crevices in the mortar or in the blocks. In fact, Gail was the one who got Dr. Haas of the radiocarbon lab at the University of Southern Methodist to do the carbon dating. While the results we got did not go back as far as we hoped, we weren't able to get any samples from inside the pyramid. It only let you take samples from the outside. It did show the structure was 400 years older than the Egyptian archaeologists believed. And that kind of upset them because that meant that the pharaoh they thought built it didn't build it, or else he lived a different time. Also, an interesting thing, it showed the blocks at the top were 400 years older than the ones at the bottom. Well, now, that couldn't have been built from the top down, so that means there have been repairs made to it, which is pretty good evidence that it is much older than they think. Another thing that has happened since then is Schock's assessment of the old age for the Sphinx. I'm sure some of you heard about that. He was a geologist who was a specialist in rock weathering, and he went over to look at the base of the Sphinx, and he says that this wasn't wind and sand weathering, it was water weathering. Well, there hadn't been any rain on the Sphinx or the Giza Plateau in 5,000 years. So if it was water weathering, then the Sphinx is a lot older than they think it is. And he sticks to his assessment, and all the geologists agree with him, and the archaeologists disagree with him, particularly the Egyptian archaeologists, so that still is a unfortunate issue. Another discovery was, well, you've heard of what Greg Little has been doing in Andros and down. Another discovery was made near Cuba. Maybe you've heard this in someone else's talk up to now. But there was a company called ADC Company. It's a Canadian company that had a contract with the Cuban government to look for shipwrecks in Cuban waters. That's something a U.S. company couldn't get. And the sonic engineer was Paulina Zelitsky. She was a Russian who married a Canadian named Weisenweg, who's head of ADC. And she describes this discovery. They were looking off in Cuban waters at the western end of Cuba in water 2,100 feet deep. And she said it was like flying over. It was white sand on the bottom. This was a sonic survey, but it was a white, just a plain. And there were, you could see roads and buildings and pyramids, and it looked just like a city down there. And she didn't know what to make of it. It was a 7-square-mile area, so it's a pretty good-sized hunk of land. And if it's man-made, then it's pretty old, because there's no records of any land sinking in our history near Cuba. Of course, it probably did. Now, this there's a Linda Moulton Howe who has a website that keeps up with what's happening. In fact, she has a part one and part two update on the work down there on that website. Anybody can look at it. I think it's Earth Files, if anybody wants to look at it on the internet. But they have gone back with some video. Sonic picture doesn't look like a video picture, you know. But the problem is they were limited with money. At the beginning, National Geographic and the Cuban government and ADC was trying to get together on a contract to do some work there so they could use equipment. You know, the kind of equipment to explore the ocean bottom at 2,100 feet is not something you buy at the 5- and 10-cent store. And not many companies or organizations had it. But I guess with the Cuban government and the ADC and the American company, they couldn't get together. And nothing's been done as far as National Geographic, though I understand, according to this latest report, they're still interested in it and trying to see if they can work out something. But the video did show what looked like columns. It looked like regular streets or buildings. I know Greg said that it might have been missile silos that were dumped over there at the end of the excitement with Kennedy back when the Russians had missiles in Cuba. But this was a that might be part of it, but this was a 7-square-mile area, and it's probably more than a few missile silos. She said that there was some, in fact, I had some correspondence by email with Weisenweg. I asked him if he'd ever heard of Edgar Casey, and he said he had. He had great respect for him.
We'll be right back with more. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. We're back with Edgar Evans Casey.
In fact, I had some correspondence by email with Weisenweg. I asked him if he'd ever heard of Edgar Casey, and he said he had. He had great respect for him, and I sent him a copy of a book, and he said he'd let me know what had happened down there. And they have gone back with a camera, a video camera, on the end of about a 2,100-foot line, which is not very easy to control at 2,100 feet, and it's kind of murky down there, and you don't get very good lights on that kind of camera. But they could see what looked like columns. They could see markings on it that looked like writing that nobody could translate. And they found some granite, which is not really native to Cuba. It's a limestone area, and there's a lot left to be done there. I think they found a piece of Atlantis, but maybe not. I don't know.
That was Edgar Evans Casey on Atlantis. And now, here's my wife, Allison Ray, who's going to tell us more about the search for Atlantis and the different research done by the ARE.
ARE has been searching for the Lost Hall of Records and for Atlantis for a number of years. One of Edgar Casey's readings indicated that the final catastrophe in Atlantis occurred 10,000 BC. There actually had been three different catastrophes, and portions of Atlantis sank at different times. But the 10,000 BC date coincided with Edgar Casey's incarnation in Egypt as the high priest Rata. So that date was important because there was a number of people who migrated from Atlantis to Egypt because of the final sinking. Before the last ice age, the ocean levels were at least 300 feet below their current levels. A vast island was in the area of those remote times rather than the chains of islands currently in Bimini. Edgar Cayce referred to Bimini as one of the mountaintops of ancient Atlantis. While few would consider the island a mountain, 12,000 years ago, it was probably one of the highest points on the vast land formation. Bimini and Andros Island, which lies about 100 miles to the east of Bimini, were part of the same island in 10,000 BC, called Poseidia by Mr. Cayce. He related that a hall of records containing the records of Atlantis was constructed somewhere in that region. The hall of records was in a temple that sunk in 10,000 BC and is, according to Mr. Cayce, covered by the slime of the ages. This record hall is identical to one in Egypt under the Sphinx. Now, archaeologists have countered that the remains of civilization in that region only go back 7,000 years, perhaps even less. They have asserted that if a major civilization existed in the area, some of its remains would be found on current land. The flaw with that thinking is that because of the change in sea level, in order to find those remains, individuals would have to go further out into the water, in many cases where we are just now beginning to have the ability to dive and search. So, ARE, as I mentioned, has been doing research for a number of years. In 2002, British researcher Andrew Collins renewed interest in the search for Atlantis with his book, Gateway to Atlantis. He proposed that remaining portions of Atlantis were in and around Cuba, especially in the area where possible underwater ruins were discovered in 2000. Now, prior to that point, one of the things that Mr. Cayce said was that the Atlantis would rise again in 1968 or 69. And many people believed that Bimini, with the rise of or the discovery of the Bimini Road, was more related to the possibility of Atlantis. While we hope that the ruins reported off the extreme western tip of Cuba might be a remnant of Atlantis, ARE's research indicates that the formations lying on 2,100 foot lying on the 2,100 foot bottom may be something else. The area lies near the location of a Soviet era guided missile bunker and concrete platforms that were critical issues during the 1961 Cuban Missile Crisis may be what had been discovered there. So very little information has been released to date about the Cuban site. In 2001 and 2002, the Edgar Cayce Foundation funded a 640-square-kilometer satellite imaging project in the area around Bimini. It was completed by a gentleman named Jonathan Eagle, and the process allows for identification of probable underwater structures. The project revealed two types of anomalous formations, and they use the word anomalous because, of course, if ARE goes around telling people that they're searching for Atlantis or that these buildings are possibly ruins of Atlantis, archaeologically could have some repercussions. So rather than saying what they think they found, they call them anomalous. Two straight lines were seen off northeast Bimini, and it was believed that these could be walls with sand dunes covering them. Greg and Laura Little, who many of you will know from their presentations, visited the site of the lines and discovered that they were seaweed growing on the tops of sand channels. Now, locals are often very well aware of what's happening underwater, but unfortunately, sometimes it's hard to know until you actually get in there. National Geographic has sponsored extensive study of the water flows around Bimini and found numerous areas where different temperatures mixed. And in 2003, there was a large image of a 630-square-kilometer satellite image off Bimini that noted at least a dozen straight lines to the northeast of the two that were investigated. ARE has decided that those are completely natural and is not going to continue that investigation. At that same time, about a dozen circles were seen off South Bimini by satellite. ARE visited several of the smaller ones. that they believed were formed by dredging and collecting of sand for the Bimini beach areas. Some of the smaller circles are apparently similar to ones seen in Andros, which turned out to be natural formations. It has an intriguing appearance from the air, but unfortunately, as they got on the ground and actually went diving underneath, it seems that everything that had been discovered up until that point has been natural rather than man-made. Five 2003 expeditions were conducted to Andros, and that's an island just off of Bimini. The first expedition examined the underwater circles, and the second, a strange E-shaped formation. Unfortunately, none of these investigations discovered much other than some natural formations. Now, there were some additional structures discovered during the 2003 expeditions that were, again, investigated in 2004. During 2003, the investigations in Andros found paving stones that are all square and rectangular with a typical size of about 2 foot by 3 foot. And those were, again, investigated in later dates. And it's believed that there was an ancient Mayan harbor with a still-existing 1,000-foot-long breakwater that was investigated, and that is what these structures actually are. In 2004, in December, ARE again went to Bimini and Andros with a crew from the History Channel. In Bimini, they obtained the best footage ever taken of the Bimini Road, and they investigated and filmed what is known as Proctor's Road, which is just north of Bimini. The Proctor's Road is a straight line of stones extending from shore toward the Bimini Road site. At the Andros platform, they discovered that the hurricanes had passed directly over the site, and much of the 1,000-foot-long, three-tiered platform was under sand. So because of the way that storms move through that area on a regular basis, something can be discovered, seen, and then next time they go back to look for it, it's gone. And with today's technology, such as GPS, they're actually able to go back and reinvestigate. But moving all of that sand is not easy. Storms revealed a deep channel leading to the harbor. At the end of the platform, the channel is cut through the reefs and the bedrock. Research revealed that the harbor has never been dredged and the channel was not cut in modern times. In May 2005, a joint expedition was taken between ARE's Search for Atlantis team and archaeologist Bill Donato of the Atlantis organization. During that time, they obtained some materials for testing, and the testing has been disputed by many individuals, and the results are still inconclusive at this point. In May and June of 2007, three separate expeditions were carried out in the Bahamas. The initial report from the expeditions outlined the discovery of crashed planes, at least one of which had been reported missing in the Bermuda Triangle. The second report, issued in August, summarized several unexpected discoveries in Bimini, including what appeared to be rectangular building formations in the 1,000-foot depth of water and the remains of a temple consisting of white marble material. Unfortunately, it was later found that the white marble material had been dumped by an early freighter. It was a facade on its way to a very wealthy gentleman in the United States.
We'll be right back with more with Allison Ray on Atlantis, on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Casey. We're back with Allison Ray on Atlantis.
And there had been a storm and the ship was toppled over. So these beautiful marble columns that they found were not ancient, but rather modern. Three dark features of which are underwater formations were visited on the Great Bahama Bank, some of which were nearly 50 miles offshore. Ship and plane remains found at some of these sites were had already been detailed. But about 75% of the dark formations were associated with dumped materials, as well as curious artifacts. For example, one perfectly round white spot in the middle of a dark formation showed what appeared to be a portion of a huge metal anchor sticking up from the bottom. This piece could not be moved by hand, so it was wondered if the ship was actually buried there. But the anchor was over 500 feet long, the formation around the anchor. Other dark features were discovered, including dumped bombs, propane gas cylinders, appliances, and other debris. Bahama fishermen often go about dumping because that actually helps increase their ability to fish and creates a good fishing spot. So it makes underwater discoveries a little more challenging. In 2007, the Andros expedition found a stone wall in the shallow water off the North Island of Andros. Numerous interviews with local residents indicated that there was a huge underwater wall that was located in the shallow water on a small chain of island known as Joutler's Case, Joutler's Cays, about 7 miles north of Andros. In the 1950s, an attempt was made to form a small community on that island, but it was abandoned after a hurricane destroyed it. The team was able to find the underwater wall, and during two trips, they spent 4 full days at the site filming and photographing the entire wall and examining the islands. Those photographs are up on ARE's website underneath the tab for Atlantis, under Ancient Mysteries, if anybody would like to see them. The wall itself is located in a small, narrow bay between what appears to be two islands. About 2 miles further, though the water is shallow, it opens up into a very deep channel in the ocean. The wall is primarily made from square and rectangular limestone blocks that range in length from 3 to 6 feet, and width from 2 to 3 feet, and a thickness of 6 inches to 3 feet, with some blocks being larger. The blocks were obviously cut and rough dressed, meaning that there were tool marks on the outside.
And now it's time for the Thought for the Day. And today's Thought for the Day will be read by Kimberly Rose. Kimberly Rose is the host of the radio show Interviews with Kimberly Rose on CBS Sky Radio on Thursdays from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. She'll also be speaking at the upcoming conference, Be Your Own Psychic. It's the Edgar Cayce Legacy, from October 19th to the 23rd at the ARE in Virginia Beach. To find out more, go to edgarcayce.org, click on Events, and then click on Conferences. And what's today's Thought for the Day?
Today's Thought for the Day is 641-6. Thus, in that consciousness of daily living and being which is in keeping with the ideal, life and its problems becomes not a burden, but opportunities for the greater expressions and expansions in self-knowing, that as ye sow daily the fruits of the Spirit, ye not worry nor fret thyself as to its growth. God giveth the increase. Hence be not weary in well-doing. And Art, I want to ask you about this because last week we talked about, you know, we were talking about boastfulness, and I asked you how you could be patient and, you know, and what, I mean, how do you really handle that? And to me, this is kind of the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
And the gift that comes from it. So I thought I would ask you first. I know you usually ask me when you read that, how that touches your heart.
Well, when it comes to sowing daily the fruit of the Spirit, the Bible says if you sow this, you know, if you sow of the flesh, you'll reap of the flesh. If you sow of the Spirit, you'll reap of the Spirit. So by the fact that it says that, I believe when you're sowing in of the Spirit, you will reap of the Spirit. Even though you might be going through hard times and you say, this is difficult to do, or I need to focus on the Spirit, and I'm not seeing, you know, any direct results. I'm just feeling more tired or something. It's at some point there's going to be a result, and it's going to be good. And it might not be good for someone's self, but it might be good for other people, and it's the right thing to do. But when we sow of the Spirit, we definitely don't need to worry as to its growth. I think in the Bible, I can't remember who was mentioning it. One of the guys going around to the different churches, he was talking about how he was planting the seeds and he didn't see anything after that, but he did put the seeds down and then somebody else would put the water down and then that church or group would grow. And all they saw was the seed part. They really didn't see the results, but they were fine with that because they knew it would grow.
That's mm-hmm. so true. And it's about trust. It's about really trusting. If anybody out there is a member of the, Search for God, the groups get together, the experiments and, practical spirituality. If you get that book, I think it's, book 2. It talks about that in chapter 3. Talks about this, what we are talking about and how we can really come to this beautiful fulfillment, this space within us of, and I call it still point because still point to me is the point where you're really feeling, expressing and being at your highest potential and connected to God on all levels. And I love it when you're sharing that because I love this about you because you really do walk the walk that you say that you do, and I honor that. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. And thanks for doing the thought for the day.
Thank you. Have a blessed day.
Oh, you too.
That's all the time we have for the show today. Thanks for listening to Edgar Evans Casey's presentation on Atlantis. To find out more, go to edgarcasey.org. Thanks to Allison Ray for giving us an update on the latest on the ARE's Atlantis research. Thanks also to Kimberly Rose for the thought for the day. And most of all to you, the listener. Thanks for listening to Reflections, the wisdom of Edgar Casey.